session number 27075, reel 12.
Gordon Leader Leggett, reel 12. Could you tell me who armoured your aircraft? Who would set the machine guns? Who would?
Yes. In addition to the fitter and rigger, and there'd be one to each aircraft, there would also be in the flight a number of armourers whose sole job is handling weaponry of any kind, whatever it might be, whether it's guns, bombs, rockets. This is the province of the armourer. And in the case of a fighter aircraft, a Hurricane with 8 303 Browning machine guns, the armourer's job would be to locate these in the aircraft when the aircraft first arrives from the maintenance unit. The armourers would install the guns in their proper positions, feed in the ammunition belts, and check the harmonisation of the guns. Usually on an operational airfield, there would be machine gun. There'd be gun. What's the word? Where you test guns.
Oh, is it a firing butts?
Yeah, range. Firing range. Yeah, yeah. Yes. Sorry, what did you say?
I said butts. Is that the term?
Butts. Yeah. That's right. Butts. So the aircraft would be wheeled over to the butts and stood up in the flying position. Guns would then be harmonised and they could then be tested into the gun butts. Satisfied with all that, the armourer would then check the gun sight, make sure that it was all functioning properly. And that was his job. Of course, when it came to bombers, he also loaded the bombs. And in the case of ground attack aircraft, he'd load the rockets and so on. So you have a man who's responsible for the squadron's armaments, or depending how many you have. And the size of the squadron, the number and the type of aircraft it's operating, there'd obviously be more than one armourer. There'd be several, in fact, to each squadron. Then there's the instrument mechanic, and as the name implies, his job is to look after the instruments. Major servicing, instruments can be checked out with various equipments, and replacements made when necessary on the unit. Very often, when we come back from a flight, with an instrument that's not functioning properly, particularly sometimes the artificial horizon. And so the instrument maker would take that out and replace it with a serviceable one. Then also there's the wireless mechanic, and similarly his job is to install a serviceable radio into the aircraft, usually located behind the pilot's head. And the wireless mechanic would check the aircraft's frequencies. We had crystals for frequencies on the first VHF radios we had. They would normally have four crystals giving four different frequencies, which could be selected by a button in the cockpit. Then for all these personnel would be engaged on the tarmac at the squadron's dispersal. Now, when the aircraft had flown so many hours or required attention for damage of one kind or another, the aircraft would be taken to second line servicing. which is quite distinct from the squadron. In the early part of the war, there would be first and second line personnel with each squadron. But later on, the second line servicing was carried out by personnel whose job was solely to do that function of second line, which would normally be carried out on a major airfield in the hangars. And there'd be various degrees of inspection on various components, which would be based on the number of hours that the aircraft had flown. And they would go to major. It would be minor or major overhauls, depending on the policy for that particular aircraft. The third line servicing would be carried out at maintenance units, which would be dotted around the country. And an aircraft of a certain vintage would be flown to that maintenance unit, taken in, and virtually taken apart and rebuilt. It was still a current aircraft. The pilots were expected and required to take an interest in their aircraft, but the very least thing they had to do was to at least walk around the aeroplane with the fitter and the rigger and examine it together, talk about it, particularly with a view to encouraging the ground crew, if they weren't so encouraged already, to regard the particular aircraft as their own aeroplane. And I think generally most pilots, I think, did do just that.
Would there be a certain amount of self-preservation in taking that interest in your aircraft as well?
Self-preservation from the point of the pilot? Or
from the point of the pilot.
Well, yes. I think we all took it on trust that the ground crews knew their jobs and did them properly. I think it would soon be discovered if this wasn't the case. A pilot may very well find once he got an aircraft in the air that there was something radically wrong, either with the handling of the aircraft or the performance of the engine. Yes, so the ground crew would carry out these daily inspections, and they'd then be required to certify that they had done their job on the form 700, that it was called. They would sign their section of the form for the work that was being carried out on the inspection that morning. And that document would then be placed in the flight commander's room, so that if there's any problem with an aircraft, an immediate check would be made to ascertain whether or not the servicing had been carried out and when and by whom. So it was a safeguard, really, that pilots would know once the 700 had been returned from the ground crews that their aircraft was serviceable and ready for flight.
Would you have any form of pre-flight briefing at all about how you were going to patrol that day? Or that?
Yes, it would depend very much on the operation, of course. Now, here we are at the tail end of the Battle of Britain with pilots who, many of whom, thankfully, have survived some of the worst of the onslaught from the enemy. These are experienced pilots now who know what to expect when they get into the air and get into combat with the enemy. The newer pilots, of course, have very little to go on, and it depends. And would rely upon their section leaders to give them a lead in the air, what to do about a particular situation. So that for fighter operations of this type, operating from a particular base over a particular sector and being involved in a particular type of defensive operations, one fairly soon came to understand what was how to deal with whatever eventuality may arise. Now, when it came to offensive operations, of course, a whole different set of circumstances arises, and a squadron would then be briefed by the squadron or flight commander on the particular operation that was to be undertaken. Right. But this is all in the future. Fighters during 1940 were engaged solely on air defense, and there'd be very little briefing. Indeed, it would be not really possible to brief pilots before a particular operation was undertaken, because the circumstances of each incoming raid would be quite different. But by and large, we managed to find our place in the squadron and do the best we could to deal with whatever may arise during that sortie.
You were mentioning, obviously, the experienced pilots that were in the squadron. Mm. Have you any memories of any of them in particular who you remembered at that time?
Oh, yes. My great friend Charles Ambrose. I was assigned to him for the first... when I first arrived on the squadron, I flew mostly with him as his number three. And indeed, I got to know Amber very well, and we kept on meeting up, re-meeting on stations all over the Middle East, and right the way through to Tunisia, in fact. The others, there being, I suppose, there were probably about 18 of us, I think, in 46 Squadron at about that time, 18 pilots. Maybe 15. And one got to know them all pretty well in a short space of time. The squadron commander was non-operational at this time, so we didn't see very much of him. Rebelliati, despite his Italian name, was very much an Englishman, and he was one of the flight commanders. The other was a very, very large character, rotund in every respect, by the name of Pete Lefebvre. He was commanding B Flight. Then there was Yes, I got to know Amber very well, and there was
Young, who had a wonderful Elvis motor car, which was his pride and joy. There was McGregor. He was non-operational at that time, having some hand injury. There was Sergeant Earp, one of the old stalwarts of NCO pilots from pre-war days. Pete Lefevre, he was the flight commander. And Spy Vinson. And there was Bunny Austin, with whom I shared a accommodation in a private house, the Watsons. Tried to place some of the others. Yes, there was a Belgian by the name of Seeger. And every time we got a scramble, Seeger would be the first on his feet. And he'd say, "Vigo." And we went. There was a Pole. There was a Pole by the name of... can't remember his name. Anyway, he's a jolly good chap. He used to talk like mad over the RT. Everybody had shouted him to shut up. Who else was there? That all comes springing to mind, of course. But at the moment, they're the ones I can place.
Could you tell me a little bit about squadron life? Obviously, outside of operations, what kind of recreational activities would you have?
Mostly the Angel Epping, I would say. Well, I think it was very much a case of getting up in the morning early and galloping down some breakfast, getting up to the dispersal, and getting oneself organized with one's aircraft, and then just sitting and waiting for the scramble. I think during that time, I think everybody is pretty relaxed. We sat around. So we're now getting into end of October, early November, and the weather, as I recall, was pretty good at that time. I think we used to do the things that most young people do, just sit and chatter. There was a Shove Ha'penny board, which was always popular. I think it's probably a dart board.
Would you play cards?
Yes, I think we used to play cards. We certainly played cards in Malta when some Americans arrived. They taught us how to play poker. But, yes, we'd play cards occasionally. I think it was just a case of living from day to day. Nothing too dramatic. We'd do our stint, and we'd hopefully all come back. As far as I can recall, we only lost a couple at that time. And then when the day was over, well, we'd be let off. It would depend on the situation, but we'd be let off to go down to the mess for lunch, if the powers that be thought we deserved our lunch. But it was always a case of having a vehicle at hand and everything ready so that we could dash up to the aircraft when required. And yes, I think we should go down to the mess for lunch, all right. Evenings were beginning to draw in now, so it's beginning to get dark fairly early. So we'd be off by, I don't know, I suppose, 5:30. In which case we'd go down to the mess, which was this clubhouse belonging to the Flying Club. And have some food, and then it was usually off down to the Angel, which is the favourite pub. Bunny Austin used to shepherd me around because we were living in the same house at Thaden Bois. So he used to shepherd me around, and very often he'd say, after we'd had our dinner, he'd say, "I feel like cinema." So we'd hop in his car and go off down to wherever the local cinemas were. And he was a great cinema goer. In fact, sometimes I think we used to go 3 or 4 times a week. No, it couldn't have been. It must have been. Well, I don't know. We went to the cinema a lot. He wasn't a great drinker. Some of them, of course, were real old boozers. And they'd be in the pub boozing away as hard as they could go every night. But this wasn't Bunny Austin's idea. He preferred a quieter life. He was actually much more mature than most of them. He was a regular flying officer, regular Air Force. Tall, slim, little black moustache. And he'd take me to we'd go to the cinema. And we get back to the house and go straight to bed. Then we'd be up again at 5, 6 in the morning. And I think that's how it went on most days.
You carry on.
We did have sufficient pilots by now. They were beginning to come through, and we had 1 or 2 people posted in it. We had a Navy commander, Lieutenant Beggs, sent in to make up our numbers. But we had got enough pilots so that we could be let off for a day, in which case I'd get on the Green Line, which went past the door, I think. Green Line down to London, then I'd hop on the tube and go to Wembley, where my parents lived, and spend a day there. Sometimes I'd stop overnight if I'd got a couple of nights off. So I was able to keep in touch with the family fairly well. And then all of a sudden, 46 Squadron became a thing of the past, and I was posted to Tangmere to 245 Squadron. 145 Squadron.
When was this, roughly?
And that would have been beginning of December. 145 Squadron, Tangmere, beginning of December.
Were there any more incidents while you were with 46 Squadron prior to your posting?
Well, yes. Quite an exciting one, in fact. This was now early November. And there had been reports coming in that Italian aircraft had been sighted over the channel. Not by ourselves, but by other squadrons. And on the 11th of November, 1940, we were assigned to a convoy patrol off Orford Ness. Well, it was a typical autumn sort of day, quite a lot of cloud at various heights, broken, patchy cloud, a lot of drizzle, very gloomy, dull, miserly sort of day. And it was pretty obvious that we were going to sit over this convoy for a couple of hours probably thoroughly bored and aching and generally uncomfortable. We didn't like convoy patrols. They were obviously very essential, but just going up and down, the line of ships for hour on end was pretty wearying. However, on this particular occasion, we'd been up for over an hour, I think. And control came on to say, we have some trade for you. We have 12 to 18 plus at 12,000 feet. And another large plus, well, they use the Angels, of course, Angels 12. And we were given a course to steer, which was, I think, a northerly course. Well, we were at about 12,000, no, we were at about 10,000 feet. Cloud base, although it was fragmented somewhat, the main cloud base was about, it was about 12,000 feet, I think. And we were given a course to steer, and we'd been going for a few minutes on this course and climbing up, and suddenly a voice came over the RT. They're bloody eye ties. Yeah, well, this started off with a certain amount of intercom between the formation leaders. And I looked up, and there was a formation of large twin-engined aircraft. About 15 of them, I think. Well, they were about 2,000 feet above us, and we started climbing at full throttle. And at that instant, as we got headed towards them, we saw other fighters coming in and attacking these bombers. And that turned out to be 257 Squadron, based at Martlesham Heath, Squadron Commander, Squadron Leader Stanford Tuck, who was a great ace at the time. And that was his squadron attacking these, which were evidently Italians, and as far as I could see, they were Fiat BR-20s. And it was a case of getting up as quickly as we could, climbing up underneath and getting into firing position to join in the attack, which was going merrily by now. And just as we were almost reaching their height, one of them, not far away from me, broke away, started diving down, and so I pulled over and fired at him. And as I pressed the button, a door flew open halfway along the fuselage, and a chap dived out and dived right through my line of fire. And it was pretty clear that aircraft was on its way down, so I left it. And by now everybody was piling in, shooting at everything they could. But most of them were going for the centre of the formation or for the right of the formation. They weren't going for the left, so I went across the left-hand side. Formation was still about 12,000 feet, fairly close together in Vic formation, heading more or less due east towards Harwich. So I got into position behind the bomber on the extreme left, and fired several seconds at him, and then I had to break. I was getting too close, I had to break away. I made another couple of attacks. By this time, the formation was breaking up completely, the enemy formation was breaking up. They were falling out of the sky in all directions, And everybody was anxiously looking around for the fighter escort, which just wasn't there. It was quite amazing, these bombers by themselves over the North Sea without an escort. So we made merry, and the chap I'd been having a go at broke formation and pulled away, started diving away to the left. So I followed after him, fired another burst, ran out of ammunition. So there's nothing to do but to sit beside this chap, make sure he went down.